He knows that he can surprise an audience of lords, and he delights in the prospect. The ceremony has been announced, but many details have been left obscure for purposes of effect. The sense of power to withhold or to bestow is very real to him, but its arbitrary nature is already notorious in the kingdom. Thus, all knew that the kingdom was to be divided, and some even knew how. Lear's statement before the assembled court, "Meantime we shall express our darker purpose," does not announce for the first time the fact of his abdication. He plans in advance to assign to Cordelia a third more opulent than her sisters will receive. But his poor judgment, on which Goneril comments later, has prevented him from taking others into his confidence. He plans, as we know, to set his rest on Cordelia's kind nursery, to give her the most opulent third of the kingdom, to live with her permanently. He never intended or desired to alternate his home among the residences of his three daughters. Such a cycle, involving the movement of 100 knights, would have been dreary and endless. This plan of Lear's collapses. When Cordelia, answering nothing to his demands for open affection, provokes the crisis. The situation of King Lear is, in some ways, the same as that which fascinated Thomas Merton and Thomas Chester, members of Queen Elizabeth's first parliament. And Lear, like Gorbachev, was abdicating the responsibilities of monarchy, for reasons that, however understandable, were bound to horrify the spectators. First among the reasons given by Lear was, of course, hedonism. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to take all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strength, while we unburdened fall toward death. Lear has reached a venerable age. He believes that he deserves a rest. But his rationale, given in this speech, prefigures in an interesting way the bitter attacks on mere pleasure and irresponsible conduct that will be made later in the play. The second reason was given by both Gorbachev and Lear. It was certainly plausible to Elizabethans, who were concerned with the problem of the Queen's successor. It is, in brief, the desire to avoid a war of succession. If Lear can publish now the news of his daughter's dowry, and notify the world of their strength and value, he believes that he can manage to prevent a bitter clash among Albany, France, Cornwall, and Burgundy. France and Burgundy are waiting, even at the moment, to learn what Cordelia's dowry will be. It is likely that, even without a division of the kingdom, some announcement on this matter will have to be made. Something should also be said for the possibility that Lear, from his own point of view, is acting as a statesman, as a peacemaker, and that he is trying to be generous to all parties involved. The third reason given by Lear sets up the conditions of the tragedy. Lear, in his desire to hear praise of himself, has elevated a family relationship to an affair of state. Tell me, my daughter, since now we will divest us both of rule, interests of territory, cares of state, which of you shall we say doth love us most? That we our largest bounty may extend, your nature doth with merit carry. Lear's action may be rash, but it suits the king. We have seen his imperial power, his coronet. We have heard him command Gloucester to attend the King of France and the Duke of Burgundy. We have listened to his strong imperial vocabulary. Give me the map there. Know that we have divided. he accepts and receives instant obedience. When Vanya flatters him shamelessly, he awards her the first scepter of the kingdom to the great generosity of the king, proud of the goodness of his gift. She does not enumerate the deer and the forest, or the kinds of crops which the fields can raise. In Regan's flight of rhetoric follows, she behaves with equal magnanimity. The old play, the chronicle history of King Lear, offered an additional reason for the division of the kingdom. The reason is not weak, it is not dramatical. The queen had but recently died. She was still being mourned. When King Lear came to the realization that he was constitutionally and temperamentally unable to take care of his daughters, he would have assumed responsibility for a son had he any. But he was already so old that he knew he could never have any more children. For this reason, he arranged to marry off his daughters, giving to them equal share, no more, no less, but even all alike, and thinking upon the welfare of his soul. Shakespeare rejected, as well as accepted, aspects of his original thought. The humanizing references to a much-loved queen but recently interred, and to a widower's battlement over the raising of three daughters, would have distracted the spectator's attention from the full majesty of Lear at the moment of the partition of the kingdom. A Lear, who had not played favorite among his daughters, was likewise hard to conceive. For Shakespeare, Lear's prejudices rendered Lear vulnerable to the deceit of Goneril and Regan. Lear had to be peremptory and egocentric during this scene. How different he had seemed in Act 1, scene 1, if he expressed even less a concern with his own spiritual purification and with the afterlife. The fact that Lear is without moral issue, hence, is so obvious that Shakespeare chooses neither to stress it in any explicit speech, nor to invoke our sense of pity for an old man burdened by the family problem of successful marriages for three daughters. The playwright's concern is, rightly, with the swift establishment of character, Lear's pride, Cordelia's integrity, Kent's forthrightness, and the hypocrisy of Goneril and Regan. Characters must act, they operate within a situation. Shakespeare had inherited the situation from previous papers of the legend, but he did not regard the division of the kingdom as an inherently fantastic act. We cannot know what he thought, but he surely did more than any of his predecessors to rationalize and to make the division credible. Lear's behavior may be startling to us and to previous generations of critics, but Lear had important reasons for wanting to bestow dowries on his daughters before his death. His autocratic demeanor could not make us forget that his reasons, as given, are not those of a senile fool of infirm and colorless years. The smutty-minded remark of Gloucester, which opened the play, had done much to establish the anti-nature motif. If a father can reject his son with as great an indifference as Gloucester rejects Edmund, another father may reject his daughter. Nor should we forget that the evil of Goneril and Regan is so monstrously, paralyzingly pure that Lear may be forgiven for not immediately perceiving its quality or dimension. Of the assembled court, only Cordelia, who grew up with her sisters, understands its nature. The division of the kingdom then has about it a mood of inevitability, an understanding of what Shakespeare is doing with the given data will enrich what may well be the most fully written theme to carry out to the theater. when that the required copy was apparently missing when needed by the tenant. 2, that the original allowed copy was missing, and 3, that the play was eventually printed in the first period. Obviously, the major question to arise from these observations is, why was the play missing when it was needed for tenant? Allow me to offer the following possible solution. 1, the team's players had overlooked or had misplaced their copies of image players. 2, the team's players refused to part with their copies of the play because of exhibit clauses, their allowed book is missing, the only source being the player's part or the plot or both. 3, the play had been put into print according to Willoughby in May of 1623, but the manuscript from which the type was set, the allowed book, had been left. But the program includes the last two possibilities and can detect a twofold implication. First, the team's players may have been reluctant to part with the only remaining officially licensed copy of the play. We know that as late as 1619, the winner's shell had been performed. And this information emphasizes the fact that, at least by 1619, the King's players were in possession of the allowed book. We have adequate reason, therefore, to suggest at least that the allowed book may have been lost sometime after this date, unless the King's players performed this damage without the license copy. Secondly, the printer himself may have found it unwise to have shipped type from an unlicensed copy. Indeed, were the original copy of the play lost, he was not even telling possible to have set type to the play at all. Considering for the moment that the allowed copy of the winner's tale were lost prior to the printing of the story, the publisher and printer would have had need of the work of a professional surgeon, whose job it had been to reconstruct a new copy of the play from Sehoff's documents, which the king's players held in their possession. I think that this may have been the case. Therefore, Willoughby's story about the delayed printing of the winner's tale may eventually depend upon three subsequent actions. 1, those concerned with the printing of the story did not realize that the winner's tale was missing until the time of discussion had been completed. 2, the scribbler himself required more time for the preparation of his manuscript than had been anticipated. 3, the scribbler who took the appearance of the document is a difficult person to find. Let us for a moment return to the relicensing aspect of the problem. Assuming that a scribbler did prepare a new text of the play, is it not likely that him, a member of the team's players, as well as co-publisher of the first folio, would have desired to register this new copy with the master's letters, and knew the fact that the previously allowed book was missing? It seems increasingly clear that a new copy of the winner's tale was the one which first had been recorded in his memorandum of August 19, 1623. And thus the issue would seem to rest in the detection of the hand of a professional scrivener in the folio text of the tale. In 1625, Ralph Kern Scrivener published a second edition of this poem, The Works of Mercy. And the preface to this poem renders service an interesting passage which reads as follows. Quote, "In some form of what my useful pen had meant to consider where was ever mean, the grace of stage is honor and delight, of whose true honesty I much could write. But your surprise is the cost of joy, and of the kingly service will be heard." End quote. Herein, Ralph Kern tells us that he has worked as a scribbler to the king's players, and fellows have long known that Kern made a transcription of Sir John Holmes' Daughterhood in 1619 to the king's room. In addition, we know that in 1625, when the great plague swept England, Kern was reduced to poverty, but which Kern had to we found him dedicating Christian transcriptions of poems and plays to numerous patients in hopes of financial relief. One such transcription was Demetrius Andy Manson. The interesting point about this document is that the king's name James Ralph Kern the right to copy this play, David Lee was in favor of this company in 1625, and had earlier been so favored by them in 1619. Is it not likely, then, that he may have been a chief servant of David Lee here? And if so, that he might have been the man who could tell the text of the Winner's Cross of King in the 1623 story? The answer lies in several strange paragraphs of space and other texts in the final edition of this play. I shall approach this problem with the following knowledge of Sam Hume. 1. The legibility of his hand and the neatness of his copy. 2. His avoidance and also his use of contraction. 3. His preference for colloquialism. 4. His also a graphic habit. 5. His manner of punctuation involving the passion, apostrophe, and philosophy. 6. His division of plays into acts and scenes. 7. His skill in reconstructing plays from actors' parts and from plot. 8. His handling of stage direction. 6. The neatness and orderliness of the manuscript and the subsequent effect upon the timid text of the play. Sam wrote with an impeccable accuracy, and his hand would have presented two of only reading fragments in the manuscript. Therefore, if Sam's transcription was followed by Jarvis and Cassidy in the story, the printed text should be free from two scribal type of error, as indeed as the winner's tale. Secondly, Sam's attitude happens to toward contrastions and colloquialism. Under these categories, we may associate specific words with Sam's transcription. For example, he commonly expanded the contraction I apostrophe N and apostrophe TIS TIN and it is. However, occasionally he did write I to apostrophe S to apostrophe TIS. He was also trying to write A to apostrophe S to L, A to apostrophe S for high, and EN for then. In the Winner's Tale, I to apostrophe S appears 6 times, it is 3 times, apostrophe TIS 35 times, IN 42 times, I apostrophe N no times, HA apostrophe S 22 times, EN 5. This evidence, except for apostrophe TIS, points to Sam's hand in the transcription. Thirdly, the matter of Sam's orthography. It is at once interesting and complex. Briefly, Sam favored YF over IF, with the latter form is employed exclusively in the Winner's Tale. However, the silliness of the swelling commonly of the F might easily have been recast by the compositor, almost without fault. On the other hand, in such words as he's the young man, Sam is the old young man. In the Winner's Tale, Jim sounds about me with a thunder age, as he's 178 pounds, me with a double age, 12 pounds. Me with a thunder age, 70 pounds, me with a double age, 13 pounds. He with a thunder age, 121 pounds, he with a double age, 29 pounds. Me with a thunder age, 120 pounds, B with a double A 11 pounds. C with a single A 70 pounds. C with a double A 20 pounds. Hearing the evidence is overwhelming in favor of C. Next, Sam's use of parentheses. The Winner's Tale contains an abundant use of these marks, with approximately 260 of these character marks appearing throughout the story. Indeed, there are a few examples of the use of parentheses within parentheses.
the situation has changed their behavior, they are deciding to become an industry. For example, they are pushing into a domestic or interested party. And in the dream, it might be very scary. Wedding health and scale, or each pick new beats, new fashion sticks, new health and beats. The very first preposition fashion appears 14 times. The command very clearly. The time has been learned very clearly. The use of the fashion to make an object to a verb is also quite heavy. She has made me feel some nose gay. She has made fashion names feel some nose gay. In addition, miscellaneous anomalies occur over 100 times. For name, for no fashion name, or was too hard by him. Too fashion hard by him. This evidence undoubtedly constitutes a strange indication of time in the women's court. Next, change the division of the show into acts and scenes. In the women's court, the first act is divided two times, the second three times, the third three times, the fourth three times, and the fifth three times. The women's tale that may see this same division of this subject of positive failure, he realizes that the failure text must have been kept in the top of his work protocol. The women's tale is already celebrated 16 times. However, the first tale has been divided into eight. The second maiden tragedy came out of town until 1611, and Bernadette, a senior transcription, was not divided into acts and scenes until 1619. Hence, there is good reason to think that Shakespeare was not responsible for the acts and division of the show, and that it was still the Shakespeare's part in his original version. But it likewise would not have been so divided. Therefore, we conclude that the action division of the failure version of this play and the indirection present in the transcript used in 1623 for the failure was the work of a scribe. This evidence is indeed strongly indicative of Rothstein's work. And it follows naturally that if study can trust you, it has adhered to the transcription containing this division. Furthermore, the fact that there are other stories in the 1623 failure which do not contain this division leads one to think that a composter is not the individual responsible for such a handling of the text of the literature. Next, the stage deal comes in at play. Here we have four major penalties from Turner's stage deal. First, he often fails to record them at all. These are two good copies, they're placed in advance of the logical position in the play, and or were generally written for what one might call a literary play. Finally, he prefers to list all of the characters in this scene prior to the opening of that scene, with lots of possible of man, of man, of nation, of character. In the women's play, a 15-scene play, there are only 7 characters, which are exclusive of the common interdictions, designations. Moreover, all 7 possess a distinct literary flavor, as the well-known following example was also. Quote, Exodus to God there, unquote. Furthermore,
Thank you.